Colonel Pride Creel, Fall. Did you enjoy your time in India, or were you glad when you left?
It's one of these questions not easy to give a quick answer to. I'll try and sum it up as well as I can. It's an experience that one went through in which there were a lot of trials and tribulations, particularly to a young officer. I think, looking back, I was a fairly sensitive young man, and my first treatment that I received there was a pretty harsh one. It was harsh physically and a challenge to you physically. It was a pretty harsh one in its morals, not quite the right word, in its general attitude to you. It was harsh. You were treated harshly, very harshly, and you were really treated both physically and in this harsh treatment to pretty near the limit of what you could take to see whether you could take it or not. If you survived this and you could do it with a smile on your face and come up for more, you were then accepted as part of the community and proved yourself. There were those, few of them only, that didn't survive. I don't think there's a physical. I think it was they couldn't take the rather harsh atmosphere that was there. It's difficult to describe this. I don't think it exists in the army at all now, or in the forces. But you really had to prove yourself. You were second lieutenant on 3 years probation as a second lieutenant before you could even dream of putting up the second pip. And therefore you were on trial, and you were made to feel that you were nothing. They tried to break you, really. And this goes, I think, through all forms of elitism. People try to break you to build you up again. If you survived it, and I did, I think I didn't like the process at times at all. I hated it, I resented it. But if you could survive that and still retain your own individuality and feel that you hadn't been broken inside, then I think you can look back on it, as I do, as a tremendous character-building episode, time that you've been through. And you'd also had the joys, there were joys, I don't get my thing wrong, it wasn't all trial. But some of the trials you went through were very happy indeed. Even when I spoke of going through a Rough Riders course thing, it's a very fine thing to have done, and I enjoyed parts of it. I enjoyed my shooting, I enjoyed my time on horses, I enjoyed the time devoted to sheer physical sports. I think, looking back on it, when I took realized in the last war, I enjoyed the frontier. There was an element of danger, and an element of danger brings out a challenge in a man that makes his adrenaline flow a bit more, and he really is like a parachute has just landed. He's got a sense of exhilaration after it. And I think I would not have missed this life I had in India for anything. I think it was a wonderful thing to have been through, and of course it's an experience that one could never have again in our modern history. It formed one's character. This is terribly important, I think, for what came later, which was the war. And one enjoyed sports and some of the elementary things of life, like good healthy living and all the amount of hunting and shooting we did, to a degree that's never been experienced since in history, for the ordinary, in British history, for the ordinary sort of officer like me. So summing up your question, I would say on the whole, there were moments that I disliked and hated, which were connected with knocking me into shape. This probably did me good. Looking back on it, I enjoyed it, yes.
Once you were an officer in India in the 1930s, did it ever strike you as odd that the British Army should be in this foreign country, or did you always accept it as perfectly natural?
I think right from the word go, one accepted it as natural. You knew and you knew people who had been there before. My brother had been there. I wanted to go there. The British Army had been there some time, and therefore one just thought it was natural. And I didn't think one questioned it probably until you actually got there. There was an attempt to get you to think of it, insofar as I think it was after the first few months I'd been there, we young officers all had to write an essay on what we thought the future of India was, and I did try and do a lot of work on it. That was about all. We weren't given any kind of instruction like the modern British Army has had since the war, really, in current affairs. And so one just used one's own, or made one's own views from what you read in the papers. And I think that one didn't question the fact you were there, and I don't think one really saw the end of it, because one didn't see any alternative solution. This mass of sprawling India with its millions, or seemed to be in every town you went into a big city, one couldn't see any alternative. Self-rule certainly didn't appear possible at that time to us when I first went out there.
So you never had any sense of the impending end of British rule?
No, I don't. I think it's fair to say, looking back, and of course you can say all sorts of things, but at the time, I don't think one thought this at all. Because, as I said, I didn't think one saw any alternative. And if you don't see an alternative, then you assume that this must go on.
Did you ever even consider dominion status as a likelihood for India?
No, because when I said one couldn't see an alternative, one didn't really... it wasn't brought home to the political movements of the time. Certainly when there were riots in the cities and that sort of thing, one heard the name Congress, but one never knew what the Congress Party really stood for at that time, except it was a sort of passive resistance movement. There seemed to be no great object. I don't think at that time they were shouting for complete home rule and self-rule at that stage. They were just passively resistant to the British, and one never really came across the leaders. One didn't get their views, I don't think, really put over in the British press. When I say the British press, it's the statesmen, etc., out there, which are still printed in English for reading by Indians. One really didn't get any sense of urgency that people were pressing for home rule, because they had no experience. And although there might have been a few capable people, I don't think Gandhi had the experience of administration anyway, where would the administrators come from? We greatly, greatly respected the Indian civil service, or the Indian political service in the princely states, which was about one-third of India. And I think they were very fine people. They were the best of brains we had from the two best well-known universities at that time, which was Oxford and Cambridge. And I think nearly all ICS administrators came from there. And one couldn't see any alternative. There was some Indianization going on, and as a British regiment, we, for example, had two Indian, unattached list Indian Army for a year's attachment. One was a Muslim, a Punjabi Muslim, the other was a Hindu, the son of the Postmaster General of India at that time. They went up the frontier with us, they got special dispensation to do so, and they commanded platoons, British platoons. And we wondered whether there'd be any difficulties. There were none. The British troops, I think, took them very well indeed, because they were both of them efficient. The Hindu one was very highly intelligent, and the Punjabi Muslim one was much more like a British officer. He was straight, he was a great sportsman, and he appealed to men, and he was a boxer with a lot of guts, and of course that went down well. So when the relations were made like that, they seemed to be good. But politically, one didn't come across figures. Administratively, one didn't come across Indian administrators, although there were some. There was Indianization going on simultaneously with the Indian Army and with the administration. But we didn't come across much of that.
Did you therefore see no actual evidence of Indian political activity yourself whilst you were in India?
Not really, no. One saw the police handling the mobs, but all one saw there really was a defiance of authority, not necessarily politically directed against the British as such. And I don't think there was a particularly anti-British attitude when one went around. You went hunting, shooting, you mixed with the villagers, you went into villages. I learned Urdu as early as I could. And I don't think there's any altruistic motives in it. It's just that I wanted money, and you got money for passing your exams if you had your teacher or Munshi in to teach you in the evenings, and you paid him. And then if you could pass your exams in about 3 to 6 months, well, then you made some money. And so I did that. And I got up to the highest standard I do. And when you went anywhere and spoke to these people, they welcomed you. You were liked and wanted and respected. They showed no dislike of you. And so one never got this impression that you were there on tolerance or there was a dislike of you. And you approached them without fear of this. There was utter self-confidence in one's approach in the villages. On their side, I think there was great respect. This may not be true respect as such. It may be that they're also very, very poor. And they looked on you as being very, very rich, which of course you weren't. But compared by their standards, you probably were. And therefore, they respected you. They've had this kind of life for so many centuries or millenniums, and as far as the history of India goes, it's been nothing else but conquest, conquest, conquest. And I think they have a natural, inborn respect for the conqueror and the occupier. As long as they then are well treated, fairly, and treated fairly, there probably was a sort of respect. And I wonder whether that same respect is now given, of course, to our successors, their own people. And, if one brings the thing up to date, maybe our administrators were very fair people. Maybe our treatment of them from the military point of view was also reasonably fair too. I did see the remnants of the old India, which shook me as a young man. One of one's duties as a young subaltern was to go and collect the money for the pay every Friday. You had to go down to the city where the bank was and escort and collect the money, and heavily escorted because you were collecting many thousands of pounds. I remember on two different occasions that as I came out, different Indians on each occasion came along, and as I walked back to where the truck was and all this, they were sort of kissing the ground behind where I walked, and I wondered what the hell all this was about. And they were saluting the British Raj. Now, where this originated from, I don't know. I was astonished and shocked. And I asked afterwards, you know, had this, had the other chaps seen this? They said, yes, they had. They paid no attention to it and didn't know what it was all about. This must go back to some part of history. It showed some tremendous servile respect that these people had for the British Raj. So exaggerated, we couldn't understand it.
What did you think as a young officer in the 1930s in India to Gandhi?
I think we thought that he's a bit of a nut. There was no understanding of what he was after. This is based, I think, largely on the religious beliefs as well. The British seem to have a great understanding as well as a respect for the Muslim. This you can see from Arabists of the past. The English have been very keen and very good in the Arab world, and we have our Arabists in history. And to a large degree, this was reflected in India too, and you respected very much the Muslim troops, the Punjabi Muslims in particular. And this religion is similar to ours. The Hindu religion was so different and stood for things that were so foreign to our philosophy that what you don't understand, you're suspicious of, and you don't quite like. And I think this came out very much with the Gandhi business, this passive resistance thing. It's not quite crooked in British language. It's something we didn't understand. You can understand people resisting you, you can understand people standing up and fighting you, but you couldn't understand people just sitting down and not doing anything. And it's something we didn't understand, and therefore I didn't think any of us really understood the Gandhi philosophy at all. Wrongly so, maybe, we should have tried more, but it was so foreign to us that I didn't think any of us thought it would ever succeed at that time.
Were you then conscious of the existence of any other Indian political parties apart from Congress?
No, I think, honestly, no. It's all we were, I think, very conscious of the whole time was the religious background, and the whole time that you were standing by for internal security work and aid of the civil power, it was usually not so much rioting against the British or the British Raj or the administrators, but really it was an inter-religious thing between the Muslim and the Hindu.
Did you ever actually see any riots yourself?
Yes, I saw them not in Meerut, although I heard of them there at one stage, but it was mostly in Lahore and Ferozepur, which was just at the beginning of the war. This was purely, was purely religious strife between the Hindu and the Muslim.
Do you think the British rule, did you then, as an officer in India, think that British rule was a good thing for India?
I think one accepted it so much, one didn't think much about it terribly, but those of us, I think there were one or two of us who used to get together and discuss things. I think we had no doubt whatsoever in our minds, this may have been arrogance, but it was that we thought we were the only people capable of administrating them fairly. When you have these bitter religious feuds, after all, think of Ulster at the moment, and exaggerate that many, many times, and you have the Hindu versus the Muslim. It was so deep-seated and so deep-rooted that we couldn't see how anybody could rule that country except somebody who had a strong hand, unless you merely allowed them to slaughter themselves, which is, of course, what happened at the, when they had their independence at the end of the war.
What did you and the other British officers at the time consider to be the causes of Indian poverty?
Firstly, there was nothing in the country in which to give any form of infrastructure or economic backing. There was nothing except a lot of very poverty-stricken peasants. We didn't see much of the big cities except in aid of the civil power. You didn't go into the cities too much, although occasionally I certainly went into Delhi, I saw Meerut, I saw Ferozepur and Lahore. You saw the teeming people, but this was mostly the shopping, the bazaars. You saw the small shopkeepers, you saw the small manufacturers of jewellery and silverware and this kind of thing. You didn't see any industries. There's obviously no industrial backing to give any richness to the country or any form of economic depth to it. And therefore one couldn't see how it could be anything else than a peasant economy. So one really didn't see how they could afford to be independent. And although most of us realized perhaps in the past the British had taken a lot out of India, I think we all felt, I think with some justification, we'd also put a lot in. It wasn't only that we put in law and order and fairness, but we also put money in that could help the land to be developed. And there was a certain amount of investment in India which allowed this to be done, which otherwise couldn't be done. And also, there was a fair amount of money put in by the large companies. I mean, people like Shell were well entrenched and other big trading companies, where the use of capital allowed trading to happen. Which wouldn't otherwise have been there.
What Indian servants did you have?
A large number, because of the caste system. This caste system seemed to be more connected with the Hindus than with the Muslims, but this is something that we disliked intensely because it's a super, super hereditary trade union system. And as a young single officer, you had your bearer. First of all, he was terribly important to you because he looked after you, he ran your servants for you, and in the mess, he served your meals for you. So although they were made into a team in the mess, meals like breakfast, etc., where you're on your own, he stood behind you, and he was the one that got your food and served you. So he was very much your personal man. For things like dinner in the mess, they were teamed, and they had to take part under a British sergeant and work as a team. Then you had the sweeper, who is responsible, and wherever we went, we never had pull-chain toilets. All you had was the thunder box, as we called it, which is a box with a metal can underneath, a pail. And this is considered so demeaning that only the outcasts could clean away the pails and things, and he was the sweeper. And poor chap, he was the bottom of the whole caste system, so he was kicked by everybody. His shadow passed over any meals when they threw the meal away. He really was very, very unfortunate man indeed. And you had the Bisti, who did nothing else but look after your water supply, which was getting your water and putting it in putting in your basin and supplying your bathroom with water. And he couldn't do anything else. He wasn't allowed to do anything else. Then you had your bearer, who looked after these other two. He looked after your clothes in particular. The sweeper cleaned out the floors, etc. And so really your life was based on these three. When you lived in a bungalow or in a bachelor's quarters, the sweepers and the beasties were shared to some degree. So you might have a beastie and a sweeper working to, say, two or three officers. But you always had your bearer to yourself. And then if you had any horses or ponies, of course, then you had your grooms called syces. And here it was on a rather extravagant scale that you, they try to make you have one syce per horse. And this is how they like to run it. Some of us who were hard up managed to bully them into doing one syce to look after two horses. Then they lived in a compound at the back of where your bungalow or quarters were, so they were segregated from you. And this was usually a teeming mass of people, because each of these people, who, to our mind, hardly received subsistence money at all, they, in turn, had to keep families who came and lived on them. So although you had a room, a small quarter, say for your bearer, in fact, he probably had his own relations, his wife's relations, and all the other relations there, and he's probably keeping 4, 8, 10, 12 people on the pay you gave him. And the pay in those days for bearer was about 35 rupees. Not very much. And poor beasties and sweepers probably only got 10 or 12 rupees. It was hard enough, in our opinion, to even keep alive themselves. So how they managed to keep their families alive, I don't know, but it must have been sheer and utter survival at the worst level possible. Now, what's happened to all those people now, I don't know, because they didn't hardly survive in our time. I don't know what would have happened to them now, because presumably they have no work to do.
Did you have anything to do with those servants' families, or were they kept strictly apart from you?
They were kept very strictly apart, but if you showed an interest, they would rather shyly produce them. And some of the other officers did the same, tried to make friends with your bearer to the maximum degree, because he was a very personal person to you. He helped dress you, and they'd got the routine to such a highly efficient degree, did you let them? I mean, they'd put your trousers on for you, they'd do everything for you. It was quite fantastic. And one didn't always like this. But when they had gave such personal service to you like this, you had a feeling that the families around you would like to speak to them. But they didn't like this. You really had to know your bearer very well indeed before he'd produce his family. One or two of us used to get the benefit of it only from the point of view of we'd club together and say, let's have a jolly good curry meal tonight cooked in the compound. A slight risk, because you didn't know what the hygiene was like. But it was a change from the mess, and they'd be very pleased and proud and produce a very fine curry meal for you. And then they'd probably say, oh, well, the bear would probably say, my wife cooked it, or Sanchez's wife cooked it, and you asked to see her. Sometimes it was shyly produced. There was definitely due to religious reasons as much as anything, great shyness in producing their womenfolk at all. And one did have to have an inspection occasion of the quarters from the point of view of keeping control, otherwise the whole thing would have been so heavily populated, it would have been impossible, and more particularly from the point of view of hygiene. And so occasionally one did go and inspect the compound to see who was there, how many were there, and to see whether it was hygienic or not. But you did this after warning them, so they had due warning, they cleaned the place out, and they got all their families out of the way.
Was your bearer a Muslim?
I accepted anybody I could get when I first went out there to get the experience, and I learned, as I said, the language. And at that stage, I wasn't really interested. My many got passed on bearers who had lots of chits, and they showed you all their chits, some of them very false indeed, and probably where they were genuine, you could read between the lines as to whether the chap was genuinely being recommended or whether he was being condemned. But after I came down to the frontier, I was very careful to get a chap from as far north as possible. I rather liked them. And I had a chap from a Baluch right close to the frontier, and a very likable scoundrel indeed. And I must say I appreciated him immensely. He had wax moustaches like an Hill-style sergeant major. He was very straight and erect and looked a very soldierly figure. And he always wore his silk shirts and green waistcoat and always looked very handsome. And anyway, I got involved in his private life. He asked to go off and take his leave somewhere, and I gave him the money to go there and come back again. He said he had a job of work to do because somebody had taken away his niece or something like that. And there was a family feud going on. I got a letter from him when he was overdue saying he wanted more time. Then another letter saying that he'd He'd done what he set out to do. The police were after him. Could he please have his return money? And so I was faced with either sending money and the chance of never seeing him again, or sending the money, because I rather like this rascal. I sent the money. He did turn up. I said, "What happened to you?" He said, "Well, he killed who he had to kill. The police had got on to him. He managed to escape. But it cost him some money, and that's why he had to have some more money sent to him." But how much of this is true or not, I don't know. I imagine there's a fair amount of truth in it. And when you've made friends with them like that, some of them are very likable rascals indeed. But he was right from the north. He was much more like a Bataan than the central United Provinces type of chap. And even more different, one would think, from the Punjabi Muslimman, who most of us liked, actually.
What would you say were the good points or failings of the Indian servant, if that's possible to say?
I think his good points were that, on the whole, he did try to give a service, as good a service as was within his power. His limitations were that he had to make some extra money on the side, because the desperation of these people must have been immense, with their wives and families and children starving, and they just got this small amount of money. And so the temptations must have been immense to steal from you or cheat you. If you realize this and were moderate in your attitude, certainly I was, my bearer, I knew damn well that when he wanted to do shopping for me and get me things, he took the odd extra bit. So what? Let him take the odd extra bit and he was happy. It wasn't all that amount to me, although we're obviously also poor in our own style. And when you had this little give, they were amazingly good, amazingly efficient. Their limitations were that they were not used to facing anything new, that you asked them to do something different from what they hadn't done before. They didn't understand you and didn't wish to do it.